So this afternoon at 4:30, I believe that I am going to be answering questions. And it would obviously be most convenient if you could let me know in advance what you wanted me to talk about, if anything. Otherwise, I will respond spontaneously. But I can't guarantee accuracy or thought. I can't guarantee it anyway. But. So we come to the last of talks on what is the order, and the order as Bodhisattva. Just thinking a little bit more about this idea of the non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy, insofar as one can think about it. And I suppose that's what I was thinking, how difficult it is to think about it, because we're accustomed to energy, that is motivation, I suppose you could say, as either being sub-egoistic, in other words, the energy of nature, you might say. Just looking out my window just a bit earlier and just seeing a little mouse running around and birds flitting here and there, gathering materials for nests and flicking their bottoms at each other. They're disgusting dunnocks. So blatant. Well, that's very obviously non-egoistic energy, but it's sub-egoistic energy. And, well, we're not talking about that when we're talking about non-egoistic energy. Then we're accustomed to sort of motivation, which is connected with our egos, with getting our own ends, protecting ourselves, gathering pleasure and so on. But a stream of non-egoistic energy, motivation, which doesn't have its roots either in nature or in ego identity, is something else again. And it's just bears reflecting upon. That's what we're trying to bring about. Motivation, which is not originated in the forces of mere nature, you might say, or in our own ego. So that we feel to do something, but that feeling does not originate in our ego identity. And that's what we're trying to bring about. Perhaps to some extent we do bring it about, at least to an effective degree. We do try to serve a higher ideal, even if it's that we put our egos at the service of the higher ideal. In other words, we see it as in our own egoistic interests to be non-egoistic. So we put our egos at the service of something beyond our egos. And that's what the order really is about. It's about, first of all, from an egoistic point of view, putting ourselves at the service of something that's supra-egoistic, and ultimately so that we are just taken over by these supra-egoistic motivations, which do appear in us, but that don't originate from our own mere self-identity. And that is what the order is, and that is what a chapter is. We're trying to, in the chapter, bring about the a spirit amongst us that is something more than us as individuals. And from time to time, no doubt, we do experience that. What we're doing in these talks is looking at how we can realize that more fully and deeply. And how can we release that non-egoistic spirit, supra-egoistic spirit? How can we let Avalokiteshvara take us over? And I've been looking at it from the point of view of the four Sangraha Vastus, which do seem to me to be an extremely effective means of talking about this sort of thing and of putting it into practice. I've thought this always. I thought this in relation to functioning in a centre, if you like. But it seems to me as this series has gone on that it's in some ways even more pertinent as regards a group of order members trying to come into much deeper harmony with each other. It gives us a purely spiritual perspective on developing harmony rather than the psychological and group dynamical techniques and methods that we tend to think in terms of. Not that those are necessarily invalid, but surely if what we're trying to do is to bring about something that's supra-individual, we need to reach to the ideal, to the idea, in a Kalarijian sense, and allow that to manifest. And the Sangraha Vastus seem to me to be a very cogent way of discussing what one actually does in order to bring about the bodhicitta's arising, especially in the context of a chapter. So we've looked at dana, priyavadita, and artacharya. And I think we've seen just how applicable they are within the chapter. We've seen how practical they are in terms of the chapter. And now we're going to look at samanartata. This is really the most difficult of the four to interpret. There's a range of translations in different sources which have what are apparently quite different meanings. They're hard to see somehow, sometimes, how they can be related to each other. I was reasonably aware of this, but Ratnaprabha managed to confuse me yet further by presenting me with some of his notes on this topic. I wondered whether I was going to be ready this morning for such a vast range of possible meanings. But actually, my own conclusions, I think, are simply reinforced by the Ratnaprabha's very helpful scholarship. The etymology of samanartata is not all that revealing. It's not easy to see precisely what it's getting at. You can see there are two parts to it, sama and arta. Ta at the end, of course, just means ness, or iti. So sama means equal, even, same. And arta, as we've already seen, means goal, aim, or object, or benefit, or good. So it means both goal in the sense of your highest aim and what is most in your interest, for your welfare. So you could translate it as same goal or equal benefit. But same as who, equal to what, and benefit in what sense? Ratnaprabha distinguishes three interpretations. First of all, what you might call even-handedness, that you have an attitude of equality towards all. You treat all in the same way. And secondly, empathy and harmony. Because all ultimately share the same goal, have the same destiny, you feel an equal empathy with each. And thirdly, that it's exemplification in the sense that you make your goal and your actions equal. So, yes, this does seem to cover the range of possible interpretations and way in which the term has been used in traditional sources. The one that's most commonly known amongst us is, of course, a samanartata as exemplification, because that's the translation that Bhante uses and the interpretation that he follows in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha series, following Terman. So, yes, we know it from that point of view. But my own interpretation is that what is implied is a combination of exemplification and empathy. And in a way, both of them are needed to fully draw out what is meant. And the two virtues do seem to me to be linked, and I hope I can make that clear as the talk goes on. At a very deep level, exemplification and empathy are really fundamentally the same thing, or come from the same source. So let's, for the time being, leave the term untranslated and try to understand each of these in turn to get at what the quality really is. Let's first of all look at it from the point of view of exemplification, since that's the one that's most familiar to us. Well, of course, the first thing is that exemplification precisely does not mean putting on a show so that people will be inspired, by what it is that you want them to do. So, for instance, if you're a bhikshu, you want to be an example of the bhikshu life, so you make sure that when you eat after midday, people don't see you. Now, that is precisely not exemplification. It's not to do with sort of deliberately manufacturing yourself as an example to other people. It's not sort of thinking, oh, I must be an example, and then doing things that will be an example to other people, if you see what I mean. This can be terribly cramping and make you very, very self-conscious, and of course leads you further and further and deeper and deeper into hypocrisy. And that is exactly what samanatata does not mean. It's precisely contradicting that. It means, indeed, that you put what you profess into practice. In terms of spiritual life, you actually live the spiritual life that you profess. But the question then arises, what is it that you do profess? When you first hear the term exemplification, you might begin to feel that what's implied is that you need to exemplify realized spiritual qualities, even enlightenment itself. And again, I don't think that's what's implied. You're not required to exemplify stream entry. What you are trying to exemplify is the practice of the spiritual path, the practice of spiritual life. In other words, you're exemplifying going for refuge to the three jewels at whatever level you are able to practice it. And it's as simple as that. You need to be on the path, and in being on the path, well, you open yourself up to others so that they can see you as an example of somebody who is on the path. For instance, if you're teaching meditation, you don't pretend that you are coursing always in dhyana. The fact that you miss the bell and miss ringing one of the bells is not because you're so deeply imbued in dhyana, it's because you've lost your mindfulness and you become distracted. And you don't try to sort of pass yourself off as being a brilliant meditator, whatever that may be. You offer yourself as an example. Well, you offer yourself as one who is trying to work on his own mind, has the advantage, the benefit of certain techniques, certain experience, and certain teachings, and is offering that to others. So what you're offering is yourself as a meditator. I often think that we're not sufficiently aware of this where meditation teaching is concerned. I think sometimes we think that it's the technique that we're teaching. And of course the technique is part of it. But fundamentally what we're teaching is the working with the mind, if you see what I mean. We're an example of, we're sharing our struggles to discover our own minds and work with our own minds. And I think sometimes it would be a good idea if we started more with that than with technique, so that what we were presenting to people was the mind and the difficulties and the struggles that we have to bring that mind to a higher level. I sometimes think it'd be a good idea almost as if we started just by getting people to sit and experience their minds and discuss what's going on, and then we'll bring the technique in as a way of working further with that. In other words, so that what you're getting at with meditation is not the technique, but the mind and the effort to take the mind onto a new level. And you are simply somebody who's trying to do that too. Hopefully, as a result of doing it for longer, you understand better how to do it and you're more practiced at it. But you're not trying to be an example of somebody who's got to the end of meditation. And sometimes I think that we do easily fall into that and feel we've got to be that kind of example. Of course, one consequence of this consideration is that if you're teaching meditation, you need to be meditating. You need to be meditating regularly. You need to be actually working with your mind. I'm ashamed to say that I know that people do, from time to time, teach meditation who are not meditating regularly. Personally, I think this is disgraceful. and a real example of non-samanatata. One really must be honestly working on one's own mind through meditation, whether successfully or not, in order to teach it to others. And what is success? Success is not coursing in dhyana. Success is continuously reapplying yourself to working with your mind. And that's what you're an example of. And I'm sure that people will feel so much more encouraged and so much more supported if they know that's what's happening, rather than thinking there's somebody who's an example of the end of meditation. I could never be like that. It's the same with ethics. When you're teaching ethics, you're not pretending that you're somebody who's a complete example of skillfulness. You don't have to pretend that. What you are is an example of somebody who is struggling to be ethical, who's struggling to be skillful. Skillfulness is a kind of art, you might say. And every art involves effort and struggle. So you're an example of that. And you're an example, for instance, of confession. Confession is probably the greatest example that you can give people. Because confession is the means to skillfulness. The Buddha says that if a brother confesses in accordance with the Vinaya, then this is progress in the Dhamma and Vinaya. So if you confess, well, you are making progress. So you're an example not of ethical perfection, but of ethical effort, and perhaps above all of confession. That doesn't mean that, you know, you're always laying bare your soul in the beginner's class. That might be a bit trying for everybody. But that you're not pretending that you are not yourself struggling to practice the Dhamma in the sense of ethics. Again, with the Dhamma itself, you don't have to be an example of somebody who has attained insight. You don't have to be saying that, you know, when you speak of everything being impermanent, insubstantial, and unsatisfactory, that this is your full and complete intuitive understanding. Yes, you. It is to some extent. It's not as if you have any degree of vision that you haven't seen this. But you're not pretending that you've seen it fully and completely. You're still trying to understand. There are things about the Dhamma that you don't understand, and you're not ashamed to admit it. So again, you're not trying to be an example of somebody who's either fully realized and just speaking directly from their own immediate intuitive understanding of things, nor of somebody who's deeply learned in the dogma and is simply spouting it out. You're an example of somebody who's trying to understand the Dhamma and communicating from that attempt to understand, with all its inadequacies as well as its experience. Again, this goes for one's communication with those who are less experienced than you, especially those who stand at an earlier stage of institutional involvement. That is, who are friends or mitras, or have asked for ordination. You are not trying to be a guru to them. That is, somebody who has realized the truth and is manipulating them in order that they may realize the truth. You're simply a friend. Like them, you are making an effort on the path. Yes, it's at least likely that insofar as you've been ordained, that your commitment has gone beyond theirs. But you can't even be sure of that. You don't need to think in those terms. Or you don't think in terms of spiritual hierarchy. Spiritual hierarchy is something that simply arises, and perhaps that you become aware of in reflection. You don't sort of become aware, oh, he's lower than me or higher than me. You just communicate. And when you think about it afterwards, you think, oh, well, there was something I managed to learn from him, or there was something I managed to communicate to him. You don't think in terms of status and hierarchy. Although hierarchy is inevitable but it's always shifting, and it's a matter of spontaneous experience, not of ranks and titles. And I think this is the most important thing of all about exemplification in the context of a spiritual movement such as ours, that there is no status. In other words, we do not relate to people in terms of our identification with a particular status in institutional terms. So we don't think that as an order member we are higher than a mitra. We don't think that as a chairman we're better than a non-chairman, and so on. We relate as ourselves to others, and if we have particular responsibilities, of course, as ourselves we carry those responsibilities. But we do not relate from those responsibilities, you could say. I think this is something that we'll constantly have to be on guard against. It's part of the difficulty inherent in spiritual life itself, and in having a movement in which some people are distinguished from others as having reached a certain depth and degree of commitment. Unless we're constantly on guard, that will slip into status and rigid hierarchy. I think we're a lot better than we used to be in this regard, but I think we have to constantly work not to allow being an order member in relation to mitras, or being a preceptor in relation to those you've ordained, or whatever it is, to become a question of status, which prevents direct communication, prevents genuine exemplification. I often think that there's something we need to explore quite a bit more, which is the way in which in spiritual life, as conceived in Buddhism, you know that you're trying to become something more than you are. You know that you're not complete. And so you're looking for a connection with what is more complete than you, more developed than you. And you're looking for that especially in other people. Well, that's very good. That's very important, that kind of receptivity. But at the same time, you have to remain true to your own experience. You have to be unfolding your own experience. And what you're trying to do is realize a higher level in your own experience. But there's a sort of inevitable hiatus between this sort of looking upwards and moving from yourself. The two are inevitably in some sort of tension. And I don't think that's something we can sort of dispense with. But we need to be very aware of it and work with it quite skillfully and intelligently. And perhaps particularly if we are the one who's likely to be more experienced, we need to make sure that people don't sort of give us their own responsibility and live their spiritual life through us, or try to live our spiritual life themselves, if you see what I mean. So I think that this question of exemplification strikes very deep. It means being an example of a human being committed to the spiritual path, but committed effectively, not yet perhaps really, and certainly not really enough, and with all sorts of failings and weaknesses, but nonetheless genuine efforts and even triumphs, even experiences. We shouldn't go to the other extreme, which some people do, of pretending to be an ordinary Joe. In other words, you sort of, in order to get away from the danger of hypocrisy, you end up with a kind of inverted hypocrisy. You just pretend that you're, an ordinary mortal sinner, as it were, and that you're hopeless at spiritual life and you're not even sure what it is. In your valiant attempt to exemplify, you end up just exemplifying perfectly ordinary human stupidity. And one needs to be careful not to go to that extreme. I think some of us are more in danger of that than of a false exemplification, of putting on a show, or rather putting on a show of spiritual attainment. We're more in danger of putting on a show of non-attainment or non-effort. We have to be genuinely making an effort and sharing our struggles and our failures and our triumphs with those around us in a quite straightforward and honest way. And so everything I say about exemplification is premised upon the fact that one is actually making an effort. So this all has great application within the chapter. In our relationships with each other in the chapter, we need to be open. We need to be expressing ourselves as we are. We need to be sharing our own spiritual life and experience with its triumphs and its failures. And I think that the chapter offers us the primary opportunity, or one of the primary opportunities, for overcoming tendencies to status. This is something that Bhante made very, very clear in the establishment of the chapter system, that you're in the chapter not as a senior order member or a junior order member or as a chairman or whatever. You're just there as an order member with other order members. That is, you're there just as an individual going for refuge to the Three Jewels with other individuals who go for refuge to the Three Jewels. And above all, one should be trying to open oneself up as one really is in one's efforts to follow the spiritual path with others. And if you do that, I think that will overcome any tendency to status addiction. It's very interesting. This operates all much more obviously in the context of a traditional society like India, where status is much more part of the common coinage of communication. It's much more out front. It happens here, but in more indirect and subtle ways, and often, as I say, disguised behind pretenses of ordinariness, which is a kind of status in itself. It's a status game, if you like. You're pretending that you don't have status, or your sort of over assertion that you don't have status is itself a status game. So I think that it's as much of an issue here as it is in India, although it just takes a very different form, and much subtler and less direct. But the antidote is having close friends with whom you are fully open. And especially, I think that means in your chapter. Perhaps particularly in your chapter, because it's not necessarily going to just consist of your close friends. There may be some people in your chapter you don't find that easy to get on with and who are not naturally your type of person, so to speak. So that you're being yourself, as we say, that is, not disguising what you really are to them is a big antidote to status hunger and status seeking. And if you've been yourself fully, to use that rather weak common metaphor, if you are yourself fully with other people in that way, it would be much easier to remain honest and open outside that context. I remember very much when I was first ordained teaching in the centre. And, well, I felt very insecure and very uncertain of myself and took refuge behind personae of various kinds, usually sort of imitations of Bhante's, which is a pretty good one, so why not imitate it? What became obvious to me as time went by was that The more I was able to be relaxed and show myself to friends, the less I felt that insecurity in a public situation, the less I felt the need for a persona in the public situation. So I think that if you do find yourself, you know, putting on a bit of a sort of a persona in that situation, which is perhaps in a sense quite innocent, The big antidote is really opening yourself up and to your friends, and perhaps especially to your chapter. And so I think the chapter should be an arena within which status is dissolved and you don't experience yourself in a status-like way in that context. You're able to exemplify fully the active commitment to the spiritual life. And that means that when you're outside the chapter, you're able to exemplify that fully. You don't feel the need to put on a show. You're not afraid that people will not like you or won't look up to you or won't do what you want them to do because they'll see that you're a fallible human being. I think friendship is the key to true exemplification, unless you're a very highly developed individual. It's extremely difficult if you're on your own, without peers, to be in a position of spiritual responsibility. It's very easy for you to start to try to put on a show of being something that you're not. And I think the antidote is to be with peers who, well, it's not that they necessarily challenge you, they just treat you as they find you. They don't defer to you, or they're not taken in by your show and so forth. They just relate to you as you are. And I think that we need to make sure in our movement that those who do take that kind of responsibility have the support that they need in order to remain at ease with themselves and able to be themselves with others. I think that the chapter meeting is a very important key to exemplification, because in the chapter meeting you are meeting others as an individual who goes for refuge to the three jewels. You are being yourself as such, and that makes it much easier for you to be that outside that context. You can probably see that if you're being truly open about yourself, if you're being yourself, inverted commas, and you're showing your own spiritual struggles, you're being with other people in your chapter, an individual who goes for refuge and nothing more than that, you're not putting on any hypocritical show, it'd be easy for others to identify with you. If you stand up as an individual who is struggling on the spiritual path, well, people will be able to identify with you. Of course, if you stand up as an individual who's a stream entrant and all there and completed and all the rest of it, they'll think you're wonderful and they'll want to touch your feet and give you money and quote you and so on and so forth. you won't be actually that much use to them in a certain sense. Beyond a certain point. What's useful to them is to see that there is somebody who's like them, has struggled on that path a little bit longer, has perhaps understood a bit more what the struggle involves, and has had some success. But you just show yourself as you are, and people will be able to identify with you. So exemplification involves allowing others to have empathy with you. And it happens, you're able to exemplify because you have empathy with them, if you see what I mean. If you think of yourself as something different, as something separate in relation to the people that you're with, well, you won't be able to exemplify in the sense that we've been talking about. You'll be putting on a show. You'll be standing on your status. But if you're exemplifying, if you're able to recognise them as fundamentally the same as you, they will be able to identify with you. So, empathy and exemplification seem to me to be inextricably intertwined. They can put themselves in your place because you put yourself in theirs. Because you understand that when you're speaking to them, that you're speaking to them as one individual, one human being, to other human beings, well, they can then identify with you. So, exemplification and empathy are closely connected. So let me look a little bit more closely at the aspect of empathy itself. There are really several levels and layers to it, and no doubt one could give a very full series of talks simply on the subject of empathy. I found some useful material on this subject in Asanga's Bodhisattva Bhumi, where he speaks of empathy in terms of compliance with the minds of others, or mental compliance with others. Sort of shaping your mind to others. We might say, perhaps best, getting into tune with them, being in tune with them. And that this has got two primary levels. First of all, identifying with them in the most general sense. Identifying with them as beings who want happiness and want to avoid pain. So at the most basic level, we've got that kind of identity with all sentient creatures. But of course, with human beings, we know that desire for pleasure and of wanting to avoid pain is bound up with ego identity. So it gives it all a much sharper and more complex structure. So we're able to identify with that. We just see people and we recognize at an intuitive level that they are subjects, just as we are. That they experience themselves as the center of everything, as the subject of everything. They're concerned about their own pleasure and pain, just as we are. So there's that compliance with the minds of others, that you're able to identify with others as persons. We spoke about this a little bit in terms of Priya. But secondly, you're able to make that more specific. You're able to make it more particular. You are able, in your communication with other people, to come to know their individual natures. This is what Asanga says, that compliance with the minds of others first of all implies knowing their natures, dispositions, and characters. So that in your dealings with other people, you come to understand them. You come to know what they're like. And therefore, you're able to relate to them in the appropriate way. You don't, just have a one-size-fits-all sort of communicative technique. You just put your face up close to theirs and shout like an Englishman with a Frenchman and hope that they understand. You see what the people are like and you modify your way of communicating so that they can understand. This is not hypocrisy again, it's sensitivity, responding to the other person. So often we think of communication simply in terms of the originator's end of it. And we think that communication is a sort of abstract thing where you just go out and blurt. But of course communication is two-way, two-sided. And you're communicating to somebody or some group of people and you need to know who they are. For a start, if they're French, there's no good talking to them in English. But wait a minute, that was not meant to be an English-French joke. Anyway, you know what I mean. So, yes, you try to know the nature of the people you're talking to, and you try to adapt yourself to them. And, of course, it's extremely important in the chapter. Empathy is vital. If you empathise with the people in your chapter, well, you'll draw closer to them so that they can transcend them, so that you can then transcend yourselves together. If you're not in empathy with the people in your chapter, well, how can you go beyond yourselves? How can you ever achieve something that's more than egoistic? You're just a clump of egos not paying attention to each other. And that's going to get you nowhere. So, empathy implies a really vital function of the chapter, learning to empathise through exemplification, learning to exemplify through empathy. Being honest about yourself, being an example of one on the path, and recognising others as examples of being on the path in their own particular way. So the empathy side of it also implies the need to know oneself. You can't empathise with others, you can't come to understand others unless you understand yourself. So often what we're reading into others is just our projection of ourselves. We read others in terms of ourselves because we don't know ourselves well enough to know that it is just the particularity of our own character rather than the nature of the universe. So we need to know ourselves in order to understand others. We need to understand others to know ourselves. And it's very much a function of the chapter, I think, to provide the context within which one can come to know oneself better and better. Of course, it's not easy to do. I think it takes a long time to really understand yourself in all its aspects. But I think it's important to in the chapter make a conscious effort to understand what kind of a person you are and what kind of a person the other people in your chapter are in their turn. Alaka was reminding us last night, Padmavadra, Padmadaka and I went to have supper with Alaka and Padmajyoti, and we got talking about these sort of areas, and he was reminding us that when we first relaunched the ordination process here at Padmaloka, the ordination team spent quite a lot of time trying to understand the way in which each of us came to a decision about whether somebody was ready for ordination or not. Because people have such different ways of going about it. And it means such different things when different people say things, if you see what I mean. And unless we understood where each person was coming from, as they say, it was very difficult to come to a collective decision. So to begin with, we'd be just cancelling each other out. You know, because somebody said he's ready, you'd dig your heels in and say that he was even less ready than you actually thought he was, and so on. But once we came to understand the way in which we each worked, it became much more easy. You know, for instance, the famous example was Surata. We could never work out why Surata thought somebody was ready or not, because Surata sort of didn't explain it quite like that. But what we began to realise after a while was that Surata's technique for deciding whether somebody was ready for ordination or not was gustatory. He'd taste them. So he'd sort of, yeah, not ready. And actually, we began to realise that even though he wasn't always that articulate, I'm sure he is these days, I'm sure he's brilliantly articulate, he wasn't all that articulate about why they weren't ready, he was usually right. And, you know, those of us who could argue that, the most unskillful behaviour was actually a manifestation of the highest going for refuge were usually wrong. You know, some people very sympathetic and always looking for the best in somebody, so very unwilling to say no. Not ready. And some people picking on the merest fault and amplifying it. But as we got to know each other and got to know ourselves, we began to be able to work very, very effectively together. And I thought this was quite a model. Well, Alaka was saying he thought this was quite a model, and that he thought that really any team needs to engage in that sort of exercise so that you come to know yourself better and understand everybody else better. So that you can, well, use your strengths, your individual strengths, to the common good and cover each other's weaknesses. And I think this is a very important function of a chapter meeting. Not you necessarily need to consciously go into it, although that might be a good idea, but that in the chapter meeting you do learn about yourself and learn to empathise more and more with other people, understand more and more where they're coming from. I don't like that metaphor, but it is really rather an effective one when you think about it. And just to flesh this out a bit, I was reminded again last night of a distinction that Bante made between different aspects that a person has. So he distinguished between character, personality, and individuality. Character is kind of very basic to what you are. And my own view is that it's got a sort of biological basis. It's actually to do with your genetic inheritance, you might say. It's just the way you manifest. Character is quite strongly affected by genetic factors. I believe there's even some sort of evidence for this these days, although no doubt it'll be disproved tomorrow. But you are as you are. Not because you formed yourself necessarily. Again, we were reminded last night that it can be quite uncanny if you meet a close relative who you've perhaps been separated from. You realise that there's something sort of about them that's very similar to you, even though you've been brought up under quite different conditions. I remember a friend of mine who was taken by his mother to a different continent when he was three. Leaving his father behind. And 35 years later, he came back and met his father for the first time. Consciously, he couldn't remember him at all. What he said that though it was It was scary because his father had the same sense of humour as he did. And, that can be pretty scary. If nobody else laughs at your jokes, then you find there's somebody else who's got the same sort of unintelligible sense of humour. And he said he had the same mannerisms. So he couldn't have picked them up, presumably through, you know, direct contact, unless a lot more passes in the first 3 years than we realise. But somehow or other, that the same character was there, or some of the same character traits were there. I don't think it's just a question of direct inheritance. No doubt there are more formative factors in nurturance. But there's a certain basic structure to our personality, you could say, in the broadest sense, which is given, and which we can't change that much. We can fiddle around with it, we can improve it a bit, but if we're a slow and plodding thinker, we're never going to be Einstein. And on the other hand, if we're really quite brilliant and so on, we're probably never going to be able to go through the plodding process of working everything out in an easy way. We have to force ourselves to do it. So there's a certain mental disposition which we have, which is given. Now, this is not to contradict anatta, but it is to say that, there's a certain hard, grainy rigidity to our manifestation, which we can't. We can only develop to some extent. We can't completely alter. We can't be somebody else. It's just as you can't have a different body. You're going to have the body you've got. You can build your muscles, but you can't change your basic shape. I think there's something similar at the base of our character. So there's something about us that just is as it is, and we need to know that in ourselves, and we need to know it in other people. We need to just see. Well, it's ridiculous to ask that person to do that job or to take that responsibility. They're just not built for it. No doubt they would do their best, but they wouldn't be likely to do it brilliantly. Of course, you can be very surprised, but you can see that some people are just sort of not cut out for certain things. It doesn't mean that they're not excellent people. So that's character. There's personality, which is the way you come across to others. You know, these are, of course, specialised uses. They can all be used in different ways. But personality in this analysis is the way you come across to others. And it's not necessarily consonant with your character. It's not necessarily how you actually are. Other people will see you in a particular way, which is to do with fashion, to do with them, to do with culture, and so on. And I thought about this quite a bit because I've one or two close friends who are really rather unpopular. And I think quite undeservedly, largely as a matter of fashion. They're unfashionable personalities. And people take against them and behave, to my mind, despicably in relation to them. But it's not really to do with their moral worth. It's to do with how they come across from the point of view of fashion. Characters go in phases. At one time, a particular character is in fashion, at another time, another. You can even see it on the sort of great public stage, can't you? You know, that's at one point the manly man might be in at the next, the new man, and so on. So personality is the way we come across to others, which is not necessarily to do with our real moral worth or even our character. And it may be karmic. I don't know what influences, but it can be quite strange. People can be popular who are thoroughly unworthy and unpopular who are thoroughly worthy. And of course, in the context of a chapter, we should definitely be getting beyond that sort of response. It does happen, and you do see even scapegoating taking place in chapters. And some people have sort of awkward personalities. They're a bit uncomfortable and not very smooth. They don't communicate themselves in a very a way that's easily palatable to others. Again, I remember Bante taking issue with somebody who described another order member as negative. And he said, are they negative or are they just awkward? I thought that was quite an important distinction. Quite often people are taken as negative when they're just awkward, either because they ask awkward questions and put a different and awkward point of view, or just because they're a bit sort of spiky and uncomfortable and not smooth to be with. And on the other hand, some people can be much admired because they're so smooth and charming and so on, but they're absolute rogues under the surface. Not order members, of course. And then finally, individuality is moral worth, genuine moral worth. And regardless of your character, you can develop morally. You can become a better person, more and more skillful, and of course you can have a greater and greater depth of spiritual realization. And we need to be able to sort of distinguish these three elements and not get them mixed up with each other, both in ourselves and other people. We need to be able to know our character, to know how we come across to others. It's sometimes very useful to know that. To give a personal example, I know that, probably as a result of my cultural background and so forth, I'm rather definite by character. So I communicate myself in a very definite sort of way. There are a few shades of grey in my personality, or at least in some ways in my public personality. Some people hate that. They loathe it because it puts them in touch with their own ambiguity and their own indecisiveness. And they end up blaming me for being decisive, which is not my fault. I can't help it. Decisions just come. And so I've sort of learnt that you have to kind of work with that and, just sort of keep your decisions to yourself and be a little less sort of confident on the surface, as it were, and, a bit more if and but and maybe, just because it gets up people's noses. I'm not going to change my basic character, but I'll certainly be a little bit more careful about how it comes across. So, yes, you know what you're like, and you know how that interacts with other people. Then you can work with that as a conditioned phenomenon that you can act with skillfully. So you need to distinguish your character from your personality and your individuality from your personality and your character. You need to be looking at genuine moral worth and genuine moral development, not thinking that moral development means becoming a different person. And being like somebody else when you're quite a different character, and not mistaking popularity and unpopularity for genuine moral worth. So I think a very useful set of distinctions, and important that in the context of a chapter meeting these distinctions are worked out, that we don't try and force each other to be different as characters to what we are, that we don't take each other simply on the basis of personality, of how we come across. We don't just have popularities and unpopularities in the context of the chapter. And that what we're really trying to work on and work with is true moral individuality. And so empathy means, I think, being able to distinguish these three, being able to get to know somebody's character, to be able to see through their personality and be able to assess and respond to their true individuality. So I think that in the chapter, if we are working successfully, these three will be becoming clearer and clearer, and therefore we'll be entering into deeper and deeper empathy with each other, and we'll be able to exemplify more successfully. If we know ourselves, we can be ourselves. After all, sometimes you don't know which self to be when people tell you to be yourself. Sometimes you really would rather that people stopped being themselves, or at least being that particular self, because it's a thoroughly non-individual one. But more we know ourselves, the more we can be ourselves, and the more we'll know others. The more we can exemplify, the more we can empathise. And of course, if we have that kind of self-knowledge and the exemplification and empathy that emerge from them, they're very, very powerful attractive forces which draw people definitely towards you. I was very moved last night. Arlika was talking about his own early contact with the movement, and he was being very kind to me and saying that one of the things that had drawn him in was that he came along in a right state one day and said he wanted to speak to an order member and was pointed in my direction. And he said that the great thing was I just listened to him. I just let him talk. And regardless of what I was thinking, I apparently at that time showed an example of simply listening, empathising at least to that degree. And I'm very touched by that and very struck by that particular need, as it were, that people have to feel that you are really trying to empathise with them. And if you do empathise with them, if you really listen to them and take them seriously, then they will be attracted. They'll want more of it. And it probably is, on the whole, a good feature of our movement, that we do take people seriously. We don't just sort of assess people in the basis of their character or their appearance or whatever. But we do need to be careful, because I think perhaps we can very easily dismiss people because they appear in a particular way. And again, another order member was describing to me how difficult it had been to get involved with the movement, because he came from a very, very rough background and was rather sort of coarse in his language and so on. And people obviously tried to avoid him. He said it was only his absolute conviction that there was something serious here that kept him going. The people just kept on sort of ignoring him and going to others and so on. And so we need to be very careful that we look beyond the appearance, that we look beyond the personality. We try to see the character and we try to see the genuine individuality, or at least aspiration thereto. And if we do respond to people in that way, they'll be very powerfully attracted to us, and they'll be drawn into deeper and deeper harmony. There can be nothing more satisfying than to be empathised with, than to have somebody understand you, or even just attempt to understand you. That can be a remarkable experience, and often for people, it's the first time it's ever happened when they come along to a centre. They've never really had anybody pay proper attention to them and try to understand them before. So that particular Sangrahavastu is an especially powerful one, the Sangrahavastu of Samanartata, in the sense both of empathy and exemplification. And of course, the more they're drawn in, the more they will be drawn into harmony. And the deeper the harmony, the more there's a basis for transcendence. So I hope that all this has been useful. I've tried to speak both in the most lofty way and in the most practical way, because the two do seem to me to be very closely connected. I've tried to show how we actualise the order as Avalokiteshvara in practice through our chapters, how we try to actualise that experience of the non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy, taking us over so that we become hands, even faces, of Avalokiteshvara. And we do it especially by practicing the four Sangrahavastus in our chapter meetings. And from those chapter meetings, those Sangrahavastus will then spill over beyond them. We practice Dana, Priyavadita, Artacharya, and Samanartata. And of course, if we want the tone of the chapter to be based upon these four Sangrahavastus, well, we can't sort of just try to make other people do it. We can only encourage them to do it by doing it ourselves, by taking the Sangrahavastus as the basis for our own interaction with others in our chapter. In other words, we can only get the Sangrahavastus to influence the chapter by exemplifying them ourselves. And perhaps it's the chapter convener's duty especially to exemplify the four Sangrahavastus. That's the main way in which you contribute to the chapter, apart from the merely mechanical aspects of the job. The main way in which you work with the chapter is by exemplifying the four Sangrahavastus, and not insisting on others doing so, but simply doing so yourself. And the order being what it is, which is a body of men and women who are dedicated to the three jewels, they will pick up, they will respond, And that certainly is my own experience, that if you behave in an inspired and a serious, spiritually serious way, order members will respond, even if it seems that the atmosphere initially is not very promising. If you just keep on relating on that basis, they will respond. And you just have the confidence to keep on exercising the Sangraha Vastus, and they will exercise their magic upon others. They'll start to join in. And of course, it's not going to be such a struggle, order members being order members. So being a chapter convener is a very powerful practice indeed when looked at from this point of view. It really is a bodhisattva practice, because it's not a post, it's not a status, it's a responsibility, and a responsibility that rests finally in your own exemplification, in your own really living out the spiritual life, and especially trying to exercise the Sangraha Vastus. So in your practice as a chapter convener, you have a very powerful tool to your own development, as well as a contribution to the development of others. It is truly a bodhisattva task. And it's very, very good indeed, I think, to look at the whole thing from this point of view, to look at the order from this point of view of its idea, to look at the chapter in terms of the attempt to manifest the bodhisattva through it, and to look at the chapter convener's responsibility in these terms. And I hope you do all appreciate what a wonderful opportunity you have in being chapter conveners, and that you take that opportunity fully and deeply and seriously. And if you do, you'll have an effect not merely on your own chapters, but on the whole order, and therefore that stream of non-egoistic spiritual energy will manifest in and through the order.